Okay, Jeff, so how are you doing today?
Good. Sorry I'm late, guys.
No problem.
No worries.
What's up, everybody? Damn, full What's house. Up? This is dope.
Shalom.
So first of all, nice to meet you. My name is Dudu. This is Ronnie.
Hi, nice to meet you.
We host an Israeli sneaker podcast. It's called Eze Podcast Vezen Alaim. Today we are here at Factory 54 as part of the Culture Club. With your permission, I'm going to do just a short intro in Hebrew. It's probably the first time for you. So you're going to hear probably words you know, but just in Hebrew.
All right.
So people are going to hear and get to know you a little bit, okay? אז ברוכים הבאים לאיזה פודקאסט ואיזה נעליים. אני דודו רייטמן, לצידי יושב רוני לוין.
נעליים.
נמצאים פה בפקטורי 54, קולצ'ר קלאב, ויש לנו אורח מיוחד מאוד ש... אתם בטח רואים אותו עכשיו, אני אציג אותו בקצרה, טוב, לא בקצרה, אבל בעברית. אז הוא פועל כמעצב קרוב ל-30 שנה, חלוץ בהתאמת תרבות הסקייט, פאנק והיפ-הופ ביחד. הוא התחיל מלפרוץ לבתי ספר לאומנות במטרה להדפיס את הלוגויים שלו על חולצות, וכיום כבר יש לו צוות של יותר מ-50 אנשים. כמייסד של Read R Department, סוכנות לייעוץ יצירתי, ומייסד של מותגי בגדי הרחוב סטייפל פיג'ן. רשימת המותגים שהוא שיתף את הפעולה היא מעבר לכל דמיון, עם שמות כמו New Balance, Adidas, Puma, Oakley ואפילו גוגל. וכמובן, המותג נייקי איתם עבד על מספר פרויקטים, כאשר הבולט מביניהם היא אחת הנעליים האיקוניות ביותר של נייקי עד עצם היום הזה, הנייקי SB Pigeon Dunk. הוא היה בעלים של חנות ריטייל בשם Read Space, הוא מנטור ומגיש פודקאסט מצליח בשם The Business of Hype. אנחנו גאים מאוד לארח באיזה פודקאסט ואיזה נעליים כאן, בפקטור 54, במסגרת Culture Club, את ג'ף סטייפל, האחד והיחיד. So this is was you in Hebrew.
Yeah. That sounded great.
Thank you very much.
It was great.
Just before we start, as a host of a podcast yourself, do you have any tips for two guys that are pretty nervous before a big event with a lot of audience in the language they don't speak usually?
Just pretend we're getting lunch with some friends right now. Just keep it casual. Don't worry about the audience.
Okay, cool. So just the three of us. There. And a couple hundred more. Okay, so something we like to do in our podcast usually, just a nice breaker, is to talk about what shoe each one of us is wearing. Okay, so I'm gonna start with my own Nike Air Max 1, Atmos, Animal Pack 2.0, probably a brand that you're familiar with. Ronnie, what about you?
Oh, actually I didn't know what to wear today. But then I saw Jeff uploaded a story on Instagram. I think it was Valentine's Day. And you were asked, what is your first shoe you fell in love with or something like that? And you said, obviously the shoe is the Air Jordan 3. But I also really, really like the Air Trainer SC2. So I thought this is the answer. This is the shoe. So also one
Beautiful
of my favorites.
Choices.
Thank you for that.
You want to go now? You going to show us your shoe or your flip-flops, whatever you're wearing?
I mean, first of all, the two shoes you're wearing are dope because one is done by my friends over at Atmos, which you guys know we've collaborated with Atmos on New Balances, Pumas, Bear Bricks. The founder of Atmos and I are like this. We're really, really close friends. He's one of my first friends that I had in Tokyo. His name is Homio. So he's an OG for sure. And then, the Trainer SC, the Bo Jacksons, man, I want to buy all the colors of that shoe now.
Like, yeah, it wasn't this color, but this model. By the way, do you happen to know what SC stands for? Because I didn't manage to know.
I don't. That's a great question.
Maybe Super, here is, did they want you to, never mind.
We wanted you to say this phrase.
What do they think it stood for?
I think it's Supreme Court, maybe?
Maybe, yeah.
Let's say,
so yeah. I'm wearing a very interesting shoe. Let's have a little contest to see if anyone can even identify this shoe.
Let's do it.
All right.
Yeah, it's the offline, Nike offline.
Nice. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
So we're in the Nike offline today.
Do you wear the big chunky
insole
or
yeah definitely. So it's really cold in New York City right now, so I like these because it feels like a North Face on your feet,
definitely.
Yeah, and actually now, like, when people are at home, like, this is the ultimate shoe, right? Like,
yep, yeah. Exactly.
Right. So we'd like to come back just a little, like, to the old days for, like, to hear from her firsthand. In the late 80s, early 90s, maybe, you are in New York, the mecca of streetwear and sneakers culture. How was it like to be in this era, to see all this sneaker movement like taking place?
It was really, really, truly special. You know, I can describe it a little bit to you guys, but it was really the birthplace of hip hop culture, sneaker culture. And I wanna expand a little bit on what I mean by the birthplace of hip hop culture, because you tell somebody that and it just means like, what does that mean? Like one day they opened the doors and hip hop was born? Not really, but you know, in the early 80s, if you think about the idea of DJing, and you know, two turntables next to each other, right? And I'll give you guys a little history lesson. That idea of DJing was born in the Bronx of New York City. And the reason why that was invented is because the DJ used to play one record, right? And he would just play one song. And in that song, when the singing would stop or the rapping would stop and they would just play the beat, the break, it's what they call it, the break, that's when the kids would go out into the dance floor and dance a lot. So a lot of dancing happened when there wasn't singing or rapping, and which made the party better because people are dancing. So the DJ thought, well, what if I could figure out a way to keep extending the break, right? So that the person never sings. So if I bought another record player and I bought another record, and when the first one break is about to end, I started again. And then I started all over again. So I could go like almost infinitely with just the break, right? And this is why the dancing is called break dancing. It's because it happens, it's the dancing that occurs during the break. And so as he's juggling the records back and forth, and there's B-boys dancing and there's a guy DJing, this is what I mean when I say it is the birthplace of hip hop culture. Cause that, I get goosebumps telling this story because I'm just imagining the first time this guy is just going back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. And he's literally inventing DJ culture without even knowing it. These kids dancing are inventing B-boyism without even knowing it. And they're wearing shoes like the Puma Suede, the Puma Clyde, the Adidas Shell Toe, the Air Force One, you know, like the blazer. And like the whole culture that we know today is born in this park in the Bronx of New York City. That's the birthplace of hip hop culture.
Well, that was a great answer. And thank you for that. I want to address maybe a little bit to the streetwear. So 1989, we got the Store Union, Subway 1993, Supreme 1994, and then you 1997. Can you share your experience? How is it to be in New York with all these great brands starting back then?
It was really a subculture, you know. And when I say subculture, I'll try to define as many words as possible to their true definition. It was a subculture in New York because this idea of supporting independent brands and music was like less than 500 people. The whole culture was like 500 people max. And the store that you mentioned, Union, right, which a lot of you guys might know Union now because it's like the store that collaborates with Brand Jordan and Nike and stuff. But Union used to be a shop in Soho, New York, that was like literally, you know, that off-white rug that you're on there? The whole store was the size of that rug. I'm not even exaggerating, like, because right now there's like four people on that rug.
Yeah.
Like, you couldn't even fit more than seven people inside the store at the same time. It was so tiny. And in that store, they were selling Futura's brand, Stash's brand. They were selling, you know, PNB Nation, Triple Five Soul, Eric Haze. These are like the early, early streetwear brands. And so this was, like you said, in the early 90s. Me, I was a young kid in college at the time, so I was like a customer. I would go in there and hang out, and I would be really nervous about hanging out in this tiny space, you know, and just trying to like absorb everything. But I knew that when I started Staple, I wanted that to be one of the first people to buy my brand. And thankfully, when I showed them the catalog, they supported. So Union was actually the second store ever in history to support Staple in 1997. The first store was 555 Soul, which is no longer in business, but 555 Soul was the first store to carry Staple. So those are my first two orders.
Cool. So thank you for that. Let's go back to the time that you're starting making your own shirts, right? T-shirts, and you're going to your art school or starting to make things. And do you remember the first moment you saw a random person wearing your gear, wearing your T-shirt? Do you remember the feeling of it?
Yeah, I remember the time, and I remember the feeling vividly. So just to tell you a little bit of the backstory, I was going to art school. It's a school called Parsons School of Design in New York. And I was taking a silk screening class at the time. And the silk screening class was meant to silk screen on paper, right, to make posters for your wall. But I wanted to silk screen T-shirts. And I remember the teacher at the time said, you cannot silk screen on T-shirts in this class. You have to silk screen on paper. And I was just like, what's the difference? Why? I'm paying tuition. Why can't I just put a shirt down instead of paper? So I actually would break into the Parsons silkscreen lab at night with me and one friend. We would break in at night. We would bring T-shirts in the bag. And then all night long, we would be printing shirts out of the school lab. And so that's how I was able to then sell the T-shirt at 555 Soul. I always think about this, guys, that like if I had just listened to the teacher and said, okay, I won't print on T-shirts, there might not be a Staple today at all, you know? So I kind of always remember, like, you have to know when to question the authorities, and you have to know when to say no. And when, you know, as long as it doesn't hurt anybody, but if you believe in what you're doing, I think you should ignore the haters. That's like a saying that they always say, ignore the haters. My teacher was a hater at that point, low key, right? So I remember then selling the shirt and then seeing people wearing them and the feeling. The reason why I could remember the feeling is because I get the same feeling today. Like 25 years later, when I see someone on a plane or an airport or just walking down the street and they're wearing Staple, like I always point it out and I'm always like, yo, he's wearing Staple. Like that's amazing. Because it's still so shocking to me that people, you know, work really hard to earn their money, right? Everyone works hard to earn money. And then they're taking that hard-earned money and spending it on something that I created is like still a little bit mind-boggling to me. So I definitely always remember the feeling.
So we talked about a teacher that you didn't like, but let's talk about a teacher that holds a special place in your heart, right? How does your art school teacher, Mr. Reed, affected you as a young designer, and what about him inspires you so much? Right, because today you have your Reed art department and Reed Space.
Reed Space.
Sorry,
Yeah. You're referring to my high school art teacher, Michael Reed. He was, you have to back up a little bit because in high school, I had no dream of being a designer or an artist. Like that was not a reality for me. You know, I was going to be an accountant or a lawyer or a doctor. And honestly, I wasn't even that smart, like or good at school. So I was probably going to be an accountant, you know, like that's all I could do. But here's my high school art teacher, which was just really taking me under his wing. And he was just giving me the time to like allow me to ask questions. He would stay after school and help me out with projects. And he was the only teacher up until that time that seemed to really care. I feel like every other teacher before that was just like phoning it in. They didn't really care about my development until I met Michael Reed. And so not only did he teach me obviously some art skills, but he also taught me the importance of having a mentor and just having someone who believed in you. You know, that was the one most important thing that he taught me. And then in my last year in high school, Mr. Reed actually died unexpectedly. He got into an accident and he was driving a motorcycle and he died in a motorcycle accident. So literally one day he was my teacher and the next day he was like dead. And so that really taught me another lesson to like, you know, give flowers while they're still here, that they can accept them, you know what I mean? Because I wasn't ever able to tell Michael Reed what he meant to me until it was too late. And so after that, like you mentioned, I sort of like dedicated like the name of the store, the name of the agency, like every computer hard drive is named Mr. Reed, like the whole thing is named after Mr. Reed. And it's really amazing because like when I named the store, you know, we had a store in the Lower East Side called Reed Space. When I named it Reed Space, nobody understood, like, that's not that's not actually like a cool name for a store, you know, like, but like, I just wanted to dedicate this space to him. So I called it Reed Space.
And it's related to and the fact that you designed it like a school with chairs and.
Yes. And I designed it like a school. Exactly. Exactly. And it was so cool because I would soon start hearing kids in the subway. Like I would take the subway and I would hear kids saying like, yo, let's go shopping. Let's check out some new sneakers. They'd be like, yeah, we got to hit A Life. We got to hit Union and we got to hit Reed to check out the new kicks. And it was so cool to me because to me, they were actually name dropping my art teacher. They were like going to see Michael Reed, you know, which was like really spiritually dope, you know? So yeah, that's the importance of my high school art teacher.
Okay. So, many obviously know you for the Pigeon Dunk, right? But actually you have a lot of collaborations with Nike way before the Pigeon Dunk, right? If we're talking about the Navigation Pack, the Rift Laser, Nike Considered, and Nordic Pack. How did it all start with Nike?
Okay, so this is a long story, but and it's pretty fitting because today, if you don't know, is the anniversary day of the Pigeon Dunk.
Yes, like, we do.
I don't know.
We didn't plan it this way. I think when we booked this party, but 2/22 is this. Today is the 17-year anniversary of the release of the Pigeon Dunk. So it's perfect timing. To answer your question, one other project that I'm really, really proud of that I designed was a magazine. It's still a magazine. It's a website magazine. It's called The Fader. Okay. If you've ever heard of The Fader magazine, really dope magazine that just incorporates music, art, fashion, culture all into one. It was one of the first lifestyle magazines to do that. And I was the art director of the Fader magazine. I designed the first Fader magazine logo, all the layouts and everything for like the first 20 some odd issues. But because I had a love for like writing and journalism, I would often be able to like pitch stories to the editors of Fader and say like, oh, I have an idea for a story. I want to do this. I was a sneakerhead at the time. And by the way, I want to date the year here. We're talking about 1998. Okay, 1998-99, right? So probably before most of people in this room were born. There was a very interesting subculture of people who would fly to Japan, fly to London, buy sneakers, and then fly them back home and sell them for a profit. And then they would go the other way. They would buy shoes in New York, Philadelphia, Baltimore, fly them to Japan and sell them to the Japanese kids manually, like by bringing shoes in bags, not shipping, no Amazon. Amazon wasn't invented yet, none of that stuff. So this was sneaker reselling in its most nascent form, right? And the other thing that Nike was doing was they would work with these tiny little shops in Japan and say, hey, let's make you 36 pairs of shoes. You pick the color, you pick the shoe, but let's make like 50 pairs and just sell it in your store. And you have to think back, like obviously today that's like, yeah, limited edition, you know, tier zero, of course. But back then, you have to understand that Nike is a billion-dollar company. You know, no Nike.com, no sneakers app yet. But why are they choosing this little store in Japan to just sell 50 shoes? So I wanted to, as a journalist, I wanted to find out the answer to that question. And I posed the project to the Fader, and they're like, yeah, that's an interesting story. Yeah, we'll send you to Japan, and you can investigate that story. I was like, yes, I get to go to Japan, right? So I go to Japan. I carry a couple Fader magazines with me. I don't speak any Japanese, you know, and I hit the ground and I'm like an investigative reporter. I go into sneaker stores and I'm like, hey, I work for this magazine, this Nike, who sells you this Nike, right? And then so they would send me to the manager, the general manager, then I talk to the vice president, I keep working my way up. And finally, I meet the guy at Nike. And actually, funny story, this is how I met Homeo at Atmos, because Atmos was one of those stores. It wasn't even called Atmos back then, it was called Chapter. But his store was one of the stores that got those 50 pairs, you know? So finally I get to the guy at Nike Japan who is in charge of deciding which store gets which shoe, right? He's like the decision maker. His name is Marcus Tayuri. And so I do an interview with him and it's an incredible interview. It was like a 2-hour long interview. He was very nice. And he told me that like, listen, if you're gonna do this story for the Fader, I have to put you in touch with this other guy who is like my consultant. So this guy actually tells me which store is cool, which shoe is cool, and what we should do with the shoe. So I'm going to introduce you to this guy, and then you should interview him too. And so that guy was named Hiroshi Fujiwara of Fragment Design. Yeah, so that's how I met Hiroshi Fujiwara. And I remember the day I met him and interviewed him and we did the photo shoot, we hit it off right away. And I remember after the interview was done, he was like, hey, what are you doing tonight? Do you wanna come to my place for dinner? And I was like, yeah, sure, I'll come to your place for dinner. You know, so I go to his house for dinner and I go into his house and sitting on the sofa in his house is James Jebbia, the founder of Supreme. Sitting there. Hiroki Nakamura, the founder of VizVib, sitting there. And then I go to the backyard and they're like barbecuing in the backyard. And then this guy says like, hey, do you want shrimp or burger? And it's Eric Clapton. Eric Clapton is barbecuing in the back. And I'm just like, where the fuck am I? Like, this is like Supreme, VizVib, Eric Clapton, Hiroshi Fujiwara are all here. And so we just, you know, we became really great friends. Or, you know, we're probably best friends ever since then. And so knowing Marcus, knowing Homio from Atmos, knowing Hiroshi, Marcus at Nike said, you know what? You're a designer, you're a writer for this magazine, you're obviously a sneakerhead, you have your own small streetwear brand. We should work with you to do some design projects. And I was like, hell yeah, we should, you know? So he's like, all right, I'm gonna connect you with people in Beaverton, Oregon, and we're gonna get a meeting together. And so that's what allowed me to then go to Beaverton and start the relationship with Nike. But it's a domino effect, right? Because if you got to remember, if I didn't have the clothing line, if I didn't have that, you know, silkscreen t-shirt thing that I was doing, they wouldn't have been as attracted to me. And also, if I didn't ask Fader to send me to Japan, I would have never have probably met Hiroshi or Marcus. So it's like all a domino effect where I always think like, if one of those things didn't happen, there would be no Pigeon Dunk and there would be no anniversary story. So it's kind of like all a chain of, it's like the butterfly effect, they call it, you know, like it just keeps spreading and spreading.
Great. So this question is kind of related to the question that was you were asked before. So you once said that you don't collaborate with brands, but you collaborate with people. So what can you recommend for small brands or small medium brands approaching bigger brands for collaboration? And when someone approaches you, what are you looking for to see if this collaboration is right?
Yeah, that's a great question. I have said that before, and I still agree to it. You know, you don't collaborate with brands, you collaborate with the people at brands. And if you know about the industry, people at these brands, they always move around, right? So, you know, one guy who's used to be at Adidas, he's gonna go to Puma, and then he's gonna go to like, you know, Reebok, and he's gonna go to Nike and whatever. So if you've spent time doing a project for like, let's say 2 years with, you know, you're not collaborating with the whole company. You know, the whole company is like 20,000 employees, right? And frankly, if you took a vote of all 20,000 employees and you asked all 20,000 employees, hey, should we do a collaboration with Jeff Staple? It probably won't be unanimous. It'll probably be like 51-49 at best, right? So the fact is you're working usually with a small team of like 5 to 10 people, and that's your team for your collaboration. And the better you get along with those people, the better your collaboration is going to be. And if those 5 people break apart and they go somewhere else, then you have to start all over from the beginning to form a new relationship, you know? So that's why I say you're collaborating with brands and not, you're collaborating with the people at brands, not really the brand. And now when it's flipped around, when people want to collaborate with me, I think about it the same way. Like, I don't really like to have collaborations with people unless we have a meal together. Like, I want to have lunch or dinner or breakfast. I want to be able to sit down and meet the people. And maybe in this age of COVID, at least have like a 1 hour long Zoom conversation, because I want to understand if we have the same goals. That's really important to me, you know? And I want to just make sure we get along and gel, to be quite honest. I mean, it's really simple, but life is too short. And I don't want to spend the next 6 to 9 months dealing with someone I don't really get along with or like, you know, and that's not a character judgment. I'm not saying I'm better or elitist. I'm saying, you know, there's people in this world that you just don't get along with, like you butt heads with, you know, and there's not one that's better than the other. You just have different personalities. So it's kind of like dating. I want to make sure before I get married to this person in a collaboration, I want to make sure we get along. It's really simple, you know. And even if the money is great or the two brands together would be great, if I don't really vibe with you, then like I'm not going to do a collaboration with you, because I think life is too short to deal with people that I don't want to deal with, frankly.
So
simple life lesson.
Definitely. So there's a lot of young streetwear designers in here in Israel, and I can even shout out a few that are in this room right with us. If it's Pere, if it's Going Places, if it's Been Taken, if it's All at Once, we have a bunch of here.
That's dope.
Definitely. So can you give three, let's say, practical tips for a young designer that listens to us right now?
Yeah, I mean, I'm trying to think. I mean, it really, I could give advice based on like where they're at in their brand specifically, but let me try to think of some stuff that like sort of equates to all brands. I mean, one bit of advice is that I'll give is that what I found is no matter how hard I try to work, right? Like I work really hard, and I could work really hard, and I could stay up really late, and I could work weekends, and I could work holidays. But at a certain point, there's only 24 hours that is given to each of us. That's the equalizer, right? Doesn't matter how much money you have, how talented you are, everyone only has 24 hours. And you have to sleep eventually, right? You can pull all-nighters many, many times, but eventually you gotta sleep. And you have to eat, and you have to take a piss, and you have to shit, and you have to like, you know, like you gotta do certain things. So at the end of the day, if you really think about it, you probably only have like about 15 hours a day to really get your hustle on. And no matter how talented you are capped by that number. So the only way that you can grow beyond that is by having a team that you can trust. And so when you add a body, 1, 2, 3, now you've got like a team of people that can each work 15 hours, you know? So early on when I started Staple, I was like a control freak and I wanted to do everything by myself. And I quickly realized that I cannot do the accounting, do the checkbook, do the inventory, do the shipping, do the designing. I can't do all of it, you know? And if I try, I'm gonna fail at a lot of the things. So one of the first advice things that I would give is like, learn how to delegate, learn how to figure out how to bring a team around you and give them the work that they need to do. And it's easier said than done, because I actually went through a phase where I brought on team members and I had people around me, but I didn't let them do anything, which is the worst, because now I'm paying people and I'm still trying to do everything myself, you know, because I was such a control freak. So it's not only bringing people on, but it's also empowering them to help you, you know. That's a piece of advice that I would give everyone. Second piece of advice I would give is, you know, if you're starting a brand, no matter how artistic you might be, if you're starting a brand, you're a businessman, you're a businesswoman, you know? So get your business straight. Like, don't think that you're so artistic and creative that you can overcome the need to watch your finances. Nobody is that talented. You have to watch your income, you have to watch your expenses. Even if you completely suck at the concept of math, then bring on someone that you trust that knows it, but don't ignore the finances, because that's how, to be honest, most companies I see fail. They're so creative, so talented, but I could already see that they're gonna run out of gas. It's like a car, right? Like, I don't care if you drive a Ferrari or a Lamborghini, if you don't put gas in that engine, you have the slowest car on the block. You have to be able to put the gas in. And so a brand is very much the same way. Even if your brand is beautiful and it's dope and it's hot, if there's no gas in the engine, it's gonna die. So take the time, equal time, I would say, to make it beautiful, to make it dope, to make it quality, but also to make sure that the business is really, really sound, you know? Yeah, man, I mean, like, you know, so sometimes when I advise and meet with young brands, or like, you know, I invest in some brands too, you know, they tell me like how many styles, how many colorways, how many drops they're doing. They know how many followers on Instagram they have at any given moment. But I ask them, what's your credit rating? How much lead time do you have on your bank account? How many extra larges do you have versus how many smalls in black? And if you can answer how many Instagram followers you have faster than you can answer how much money you have in your bank, you need to like readjust your priorities. You should know both numbers like this.
Right, okay, thank you.
Let's talk a little bit more about collaborations. So you do like collaboration with iconic brands, like the biggest brands in the world. You just had a collaboration with Coca-Cola, which I think is one of the most, if not the most, recognizable brand in the world. So we obviously understand that when a designer do a collaboration with a brand, yeah, it has a lot of impact on the design. But I think many people want to know if it's not a designer, if it's an artist, if I don't know, let's say, I don't know, it's Nike and Travis Scott, how much then the artists have an impact on the design and how much comes from the company itself?
It depends on the artists. You know, a lot of artists have like a really good visual language. Obviously, to me, the best one is Kanye West, as everyone knows. You know, he's a musical artist, but has incredible artistic vision. I think the second best is probably Pharrell Williams at having like an incredible creative vision. But you know, you get other people like, let me think of one.
We want names.
Who?
I said we want names.
Drake. Drake, I think, doesn't really have great creative vision. You know, like his OVO line is like, it's cool, but like all of the Nike stuff he does is like all white or all gray or all black with a logo on it, right? Very, very different than when you think about Kanye West. And so I just think every artist is gonna have a different priority. You know what I mean? Drake's priority, it seems like, is to have almost like crew wear. Like he wants a uniform for his crew. You know, Nocta is like a whole uniform. And like, you look at the way he showed up at the Super Bowl, like all 20 people wearing the same outfit. Like he wants like an army. Whereas, you know, Trav and Kanye and Pharrell want something much more unique and specialized for their taste. And so every artist is going to have a different thing. Now, if you are an artist and you get called into Nike, Adidas, or Puma and to have a collaborative meeting, if you go by yourself, right, and you yourself are not like a big name artist, but maybe you're more like a musician or an overall creative, if you go by yourself, they're probably going to take advantage of the situation. But I say that hesitantly because it's not even taking advantage of the situation. They just want to get shit done. They have deadlines, they have budgets, they want to get a shoe out. So they're what they're going to say is like, hey, let's use our team, like Puma's design team or Adidas' design team to do this, and we can show you for approval because we have to like keep going, you know? We can't wait for you to learn Photoshop. You know what I mean? Like, we got to keep it going. Yeah. So it's not really taking advantage. They're just like, they're just being a business. But if you come with your own team of like, graphic designer, 3D renderer, motion artist, then it's like, no, we got this whole thing. I'm going to have my guys do it, which was actually Kanye and Virgil, right? Like Kanye was like, no, my guy Virgil can do this. My guy Don C can do this. You don't have to do it, you know? And so then you get really special product for the artist.
Okay.
I want to add one more thing. I want to add one more thing.
Sure.
Don't think you have to have Virgil and Don C. Like your version of Virgil and Don C is sitting next to you right now. You know what I mean? Like, you don't have to think, wow, I'm so young, how am I gonna get Virgil Abloh to like be my designer? No, don't think of it that way. Like, Virgil and Kanye were homies from like the very beginning. So the guy or the girl sitting next to you is your Kanye and Virgil. You know what I mean? Like, you don't have to shoot for the stars. You can grow together. I just wanted to add that important point.
Great. Ronnie, you're my Kanye.
And you're my Stephen Smith.
Okay, so we want to talk about the Pigeon Dunk. Obviously, we can't have a conversation without mentioning it, especially today, that we're celebrating 17 years of the release of the OG Dunk. Let's say for our entry-level sneakerheads, can you just give us a recap of what happened during that historic day?
So again, as you mentioned, you know, we had already done many projects with Nike. And at this point, this was like probably our it's like our 10th collaboration with Nike at this point. And so I remember the Nike SB team said, you know, this is back in 2003, they started the conversation, which was like 2005 is gonna be a big anniversary year for the Dunk. And we wanna do a Dunk that's dedicated to New York. You know, we're gonna do a Japan Dunk, a Paris Dunk, a London Dunk, an LA Dunk, and a New York Dunk. And we want to know if you, Jeff, would be interested in doing the New York Dunk. I remember this phone call. I'll never forget this phone call. And I was like, you want me to design the New York City dunk for the anniversary of the dunk? And you're asking me. And they're like, yes. I was like, hold on, please. Like, I'm fucking crazy and shit. Like, I was like, yes, I will do that. Yes, you know, and so that's when we began the 2-year process. It took 2 years to design and sample the pigeon dung. And then it released on this day, February 22nd in 2005. And when it happened, you know, as you've seen on all the news headlines and the newspaper and the evening news, it was a situation that went from a camp out and a you know, like a sort of lineup sneaker release, which was very, very rare back then. There was almost no sneaker lineups back then. So the idea that kids were camping out in February in New York, which is very, very cold, for 5 days before the release was already kind of crazy. And then of course, when it released, all the people waiting in line got out of hand and it got a little bit too crazy. And it, you know, some violence occurred, some fighting occurred, a riot occurred, people got arrested, people brought weapons. It was a typical downtown New York City fucking shit, you know, like downtown New York type stuff. And so it immediately got the headlines of the newspaper and news articles. And then the next day, which was the most important thing that, you know, I have to say the pigeon dunk is like, from a design standpoint, it's okay. It's like, it's a solid looking shoe. But the reason why it's so historic is not because of the design of the shoe. It's because on the next day, on February 23rd, 2005, everyone in the world knew about the subculture of sneakers. A sneakerhead back then was very niche. And on February 23rd, sneakerheads became mainstream. And people credit or blame, depending on who you talk to, people credit or blame the pigeon dunk for breaking that door open, you know? And so that's what happened. I should write that in an Instagram post. Cause that people forget that February 23rd is the day shit went crazy.
So he should celebrate also tomorrow, you're saying?
Yeah, exactly.
So we actually have one question from our Instagram followers. We had this Instagram question for, and we picked one of our followers. He's actually here. His name is Rotem Arad. He's a Nike manager here in Israel, one of the stores. So the question goes like this. If you could do anything differently about the release of the original Pigeon Dunk, what would it be?
I would get 1,000 more pairs. Yeah.
What was the number back then?
More pairs would be great. 150.
150. I see. Yeah. So actually, when is the last time you wore your Pigeon Dunk, the gray one, the original one?
I never wear them.
Never?
Nah, too much. No. Nah.
Not even the first days after the release or something?
Oh, I did. Yeah. In the beginning, I wore them a lot. I actually even wore them to play basketball. It was crazy. People were like freaking out. But today, I don't wear them.
And when was the last time you saw somebody else wearing them? Like just that casually?
I see it pretty often. Yeah, I see it pretty often, people wearing them. I'm surprised. It's crazy.
So just one more follow-up question about that. You once said that the Pigeon Dunk is your blessing and curse. Do you still believe that in that sentence?
Yeah, I mean, it's a blessing that I was able to design something that meant so much to a culture, and that culture now is no longer a subculture. It's like really mainstream culture. So it's like even my friends who are like doctors and lawyers know about sneaker culture now. You know, like you don't even have to be in the culture to know about sneaker culture at this point. So it's a blessing to always have this thing that is connected to that, but it's also a curse because me as a creative and a designer and artist and a business person, I always am moving forward and doing new things, you know, but it's hard to eclipse what happened in the past, you know, because that was such a monumentous moment. And I always think about like musicians and artists who made like a super hit song, you know what I mean? Like you think about like Pharrell Williams, right? He's done so many amazing things. And I bet every time he does a show, they have to say, can you sing Happy? Can you do the song Happy? You know, like, or like if Nas is gonna do a show, they're gonna be like, you gotta do Illmatic. You have to do like what? He's like, that's 20 years ago. I still have to sing the Illmatic song. You know, I still have to do Happy. you know, but so that's the curse part of it. But I've learned to understand that, like, even the curse is a gift, that people appreciate this thing so much. Like, you know, even today, I didn't realize that today was the anniversary until I woke up this morning and saw everyone celebrating on my phone. I really totally forgot. And it's great that, like, you know, people like Sneaker Freaker and Hypebeast and High Snuff, they all, like, marked this almost as like a national holiday for sneakerheads, that this was the day, man. This was the day the culture was maybe born to the masses, you know. So that's really appreciative for me.
And we're talking 17 years, something that happened 17 years ago. So it's, yeah, it's big. Let's talk about New Balance for a second, okay? My personal favorite. Today I'm wearing Nike, but usually it's New Balance. You said once in one of your interviews that the companies that you collaborate with, you choose to use the pigeon symbol, the pigeon logo, only on special, with special companies, okay? Or it only with companies that mean something to you, something iconic. Why in New Balance you decided to use the flying pigeon for the first time, or use a different logo of the pigeon? Is there a reason behind that?
Wow, you do your homework, man. You know a lot. That's great. Yeah, that was a deliberate move. You know, at the time, I think Nike wasn't too happy about me talking to New Balance, okay? But at the same time, Nike wasn't really giving out, like, Virgil Abloh-style contracts. You know what I mean? They weren't signing people for, like, 3 to 5 year deals. They were doing, like, one shoe at a time deal. So from my perspective, I was like, yeah, Nike, if you want to do another shoe, let's do another shoe. I'm totally down to say no to other people. But if you're not saying that, then I'm going to work with other brands that I really love. Like, New Balance is a great brand. We can all appreciate that New Balance is a great brand. Why would I not want to work with them unless you're giving me something? And so they were like, yeah, we can't guarantee you another shoe. And so when we did something with New Balance, I thought, and it was, this was a, almost like a collective three-way decision where, like, maybe we should do something a little bit different for New Balance. I mean, New Balance wants that. I assume Nike would want that. And I wanted that too. So we made the flying version of the pigeon for New Balance, which made that one very, very special. And I'm happy we did that. And you know what's one of my favorite, one of the things that I'm most blessed about, to be honest, is that, don't forget, after the OG pigeon, we came back with the What the Dunk pigeon, and then the Black pigeon, and then the Panda pigeon after that. So even though Nike was a little bit like, oh, why did you go to New Balance? I was able to maintain my brand enough that, like, they wanted to come back again and again and again. You know what I mean? So super blessed about that, that, like, we were able to maintain, like, a great relationship. And yeah, that's the story of why the flying pigeon was born.
Nice, thank you.
Let's talk about another project you have, which is the Business of Hype. In my opinion, and I'm sure many more, one of the most interesting, inspiring, and education podcast out there in the fashion world. So thank you for that. What made you create podcasts, The Deal specifically, you know, the behind the scenes of the fashion world?
Yeah, the birth of Business of Hype was pretty cool because it was actually like it was a long time in developing. And I not to say that we were developing the show for a long time, but the idea of it was born through social media. So I remember back in the day when I had a blog, and then that blog transformed into Twitter, and then Twitter transformed into Instagram. Whenever I would sit down and have coffee or lunch with someone in the industry, like a peer, and I would shoot a picture or post a picture that I'm hanging out with whoever, Sean Witherspoon, Jerry Lorenzo, whatever, people in the comments would say, I wish I was a fly on the wall in that meeting that you had, right? That was always the I wish I was there, just not even participating, because the concept of a fly on the wall means that you're just there listening to two people talk. And then so I started to think about, and then podcasts became really popular. And I started to think about, what if there was a show where the listener is the fly on the wall? So it's not even like an interview show. It's me talking to one of my peers. We're having a conversation. The subject matter is about how they took their creative pursuit and made a business out of it. But the listener is just the fly on the wall. And the other cool thing that I added in the feature of the podcast, as you know, is in case something that was said or discussed was like too complicated or too quick or you missed it, I oftentimes interrupt the show, right? I'll stop the show in the middle and then I will recap what was going on or what I thought about it, right? So it's almost like this idea of breaking the fourth wall is what they call it in the movie industry. It's almost like if you were the fly on the wall and me and Jerry Lorenzo were having lunch, I would be like, Jerry, hold on 1 second. Hey, fly, did you understand what we just said? Let me explain it to you just in case, right? And people love that element of the show because it was like, wow, you're like breaking down how you process that information. And that was the simple concept behind it. And I remember I was having dinner with the founder of Hypebeast, Kevin Ma, and we were just talking about this idea. And he offered like, hey, let's give it a try. Let's put it on Hypebeast. What better platform is there than Hypebeast to do this show on? So I said yes, and we did a 3-episode test. He said, let's try it for 3 episodes. And we did Hiroshi Fujiwara number 1, Sarah Andelman Collette number 2, and Aaron Levant, who was the founder of the Agenda Trade Show and the founder of ComplexCon and the founder of Network now, right? That guy. I did those as my first 3 episodes. And after that, we just never stopped. We've done over 110 episodes now. So it's just become a cultural phenomenon. It's really amazing.
It's really great, and I really enjoy listening to it. So just, you know, keep up bringing us more episodes. Let's pretend we are in the business of hype right now, and I'll ask you a question. We used to see there used to be a lot of small community-based boutiques. But today it seems like they all become big stores. And those are only actually the ones that succeed. So do you think in this current climate, is there still room for a community-based boutique stores?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I just think that a small boutique now has to be more than just get a space and hang up clothes and hope that people come and shop, you know, because you have to contend with online shopping, you have to contend with Amazon, you have to contend with apps, you know, sneakers app, Adidas Confirmed app and all that stuff. So the one thing that those bigger stores and e-commerce stores have not been able to replicate is actually what's happening in your store right now. Like this cultural moment of people gathering, sharing ideas and just hanging out cannot be replicated on the sneakers app yet, right? And I say yet because you never know what could happen, but for the foreseeable future, the culture needs this to happen. And so if you open a store, I think you have to be able to accommodate this kind of goodwill, good vibe, brainstorming to happen, you know, and quite frankly, like a lot of that comes from like the food and beverage industry, right? So if you open like, you know, like that Ame Leon Dore store in New York is so dope because they have this dope cafe and bakery in the front of it that everyone wants to just get great coffee at, you know? So those are the things like food, dining, community, talks. These are the things that like still work better in real life than digital. And so I think if you're gonna open a store, you have to lean into those elements.
Yeah, so same with Kith, right? They have also their ice cream there. And if we're talking about Kith, we're talking about Roni Feig, which is originally Israeli. It's something that we like to mention and to be proud of our Israeli, you know, ambassadors over the world. Have you been ever to Israel?
I've never been, no. I really want to go.
Okay, so we obviously invite you because, you know, you said one of your podcasts that you always get inspired even by food, right? So the scene here is going to be pretty awesome for you. So we invite you to come to Israel. So we talked about the past. We talked about the present. Let's talk a little bit about the future. Okay. And when I'm talking about the future, I'm talking obviously about the metaverse. Okay. Web 3.0. You're a big supporter, really early adapter. Can you tell us a little bit more about the Stapleverse, the Meta Pigeon, and exactly how do you see the new possibilities in the world of sneakers and streetwear in this universe?
Yeah, I mean, I'm personally really excited about the metaverse for 2 main reasons. Number one is like complete, utter creative freedom, right? Like when you design a clothing line or a shoe, you're beholden to what happens in the physical universe, whether it's like manufacturing or minimums or supply chain delays. You know, you guys have all heard about the stories of how like all the supply chain is blocked because of COVID, but in the metaverse, none of that exists. You don't have to worry about any of that stuff. So the only limitation you have is your imagination and the ability to code it, you know, like develop it. But other than that, you can pretty much do anything you dream of. It's very much like almost maybe like how Walt Disney was when he was inventing Disneyland, or like how the Marvel, you know, Marvel Cinematic Universe was born. Like, just you can dream it, you know what I mean? But even easier, because you don't even have to make the theme park or the movie now, you know, it's even easier. So it's really key. And then the other thing that's really key for me is the ownership of your intellectual property, you know, like the things that I've done with Artifact and the MetaPigeon and the Stapleverse right now, no matter how many times it resells or trades, I'm always tied to it as the creator getting a percentage of the royalty. And it's up to me how much royalty that I want to get, you know? So sometimes I often think like, can you imagine if the original Pigeon Dunk, every time it resold from $100 to $300 to $500 to $50,000 to $90,000, every time I got a percentage of that, it would be crazy, you know? Or any artist, even a painter right now, if you're a painter and you sell it to a gallery, you make the money one time, but then after the gallery sells it and then the owner sells it, you no longer see the profits anymore. But with the metaverse, all of it is secured on the blockchain. So I think it's a game changer for creatives to really be able to own their intellectual property and their IP. It's going to be a financial game changer for people.
And in sense of sneakers, can you imagine a camp out in the metaverse?
Very interesting. Yeah, you're right.
Just holding people in front of the computers, doing a capture every hour or something like that.
Yeah, I know.
Okay, so
there is this thing called allow lists. You know, they do have allow listing, which is like sort of early bird entry and stuff. You know, so there is a, kind of a concept like that.
Yeah. So before we finish, the audience here knows there is a surprise because they've put their name into a raffle. So do you want to tell us about it a little bit? What's the present exactly?
Yeah. Well, I think it's very fitting because today's the anniversary day of the Pigeon Dunk, and we have secured a pair of Panda Pigeon Dunks. They're also the pair that comes in the bamboo box. So we have a special edition. If you look on StockX right now, I don't even know how much the latest price is, but it's probably a couple thousand dollars for the bamboo box edition of the Panda Pigeon Dunk. I think we have, if I'm not mistaken, we have either a size 9 or a size 9.5 available for the winner. So if it's not your size, sorry, but you can maybe trade it for your size.
I don't think it would mind.
But we're going to do a drawing right now, and somebody in the audience here is going to get that pair of Panda Pigeon Dunks.
Definitely. So we're going to start right now.
Yeah.
Okay. A lot of responsibility. Okay, not looking. Yeah. Which one did you mark, did you? Yeah. This one.
Okay, so let me read it, and then I'm going to show it. Or you want to? Okay, so we have Itamar, size 47. Okay, so good luck fitting, yeah.
We're going to split it later, okay?
The guy in behind, yeah, with the blue jacket.
What?
Okay, so.
What's a size 47?
What's the size 47? It's a 13 and a half. $13. So good luck with that. I'm sure that somebody here wanna.
Yeah, good luck with that. Trade. Someone, you could sell the ticket. You should tell them to sell the ticket.
As an NFT. Okay, so.
Yeah,
I guess.
Exactly.
Okay, so we were told that we have 5 more minutes, so we're going to go to our question bank.
Okay.
What's the craziest thing you've done to get a sneaker?
This is going to be the worst answer for you guys because I don't have to do much to get a sneaker. I just ask the person. Sorry, I've never waited in line. I've never paid resell.
Never.
And I don't even really ask. No, never. Yeah, I stay on the creator side. If I can't get it, then fate just doesn't want me to have it. But and even very rarely do I ask somebody if they can hook me up with a pair of sneakers. Like, I think the last sneaker that I ever asked for was the first Sakai Nike. That was the one where I was like, yeah, I really want to have these. I'm going to ask somebody for these. But other than that, I just let the universe determine if I can get it or not. And I just I want to say thank you to all the brands who like bless me with stuff. I'm super appreciative. But any brand marketing person will tell you that like Jeff Staple never asks for shoes. Never.
You sound very proud of that. So beside the Nike Offline, like what is your favorite shoe right now? And what is your sneaker rotation?
Good question. Right now, it's really interesting. It's probably more unique than it's ever been. I've been really into Crocs recently, right? That's a new one.
The Salehi?
I have all the Salehis, love those. I've been wearing a lot of, you talk about New Balance. One of my favorite New Balances to rock is the Double Taps Olive New Balance. Still love those. I still love the Mars Yard. I wear that a lot. You know, the hype culture is so interesting because everyone now has like the most hypest shoes on ever. Like every week there's like a new hype shoe. So I try to wear stuff that has a little bit more like longevity. Like that's why I like Mars Yard and Double Taps New Balances, because even though those are a few years old now, when I wear those and walk into a room, people are still like, oh shit, like he's wearing the Mars Yard out, you know? And as a sneakerhead, I still love that feeling of making people be like, oh my God, he's got those on, you know? So those are some of my favorites.
You got the first version or the 2.0?
Both.
Which one?
Both. I said about the Mars Yard, you got the first version or the 2.0?
I have both versions. Obviously. And I have the boot, but the one that I wear is the first one. I wear the first ones, yeah. Like I still wear the acronym Air Maxes, you know, the slip-on. I still love those. These are like 4 or 5 year old shoes now, but there's nothing yet that I see today that comes out that I feel like is gonna be a classic. You know, they're like very trendy and very hype, but there's not too many shoes that come out where I'm like, that's a classic shoe.
What do you think about the new collab with Nike Blazer with the acronym? With a...
Adjustable, yeah. Or that you
not
can...
Not my
cup of tea.
Errolson is my brother. Like me and Errolson are like bros, you know, we're like brothers from different parents. But the new Blazer is not my cup of tea. It's okay. It doesn't have to be.
Thanks for
not
the
my jam.
Yeah. So let's say last question. Any brands you're excited about in 2022?
Sorry, you cut out that last question. Can you say it again?
Any brands you're excited for in 2022?
Yeah, so many. I love the idea that all these new brands are coming out that like are really catching a lot of heat, you know, like Salomon, S-Lab is dope. Hoka, I love what they're doing. Even Merrell and Brooks, I think they're doing exciting stuff. So all these new brands, I think, are really making a way now. You know, it's not just Adidas and Nike anymore, you know?
Yeah.
We have some great stuff, more great stuff coming with Puma. So it's anyone's game right now. That's what I really love about the culture.
Okay, so unfortunately, it seems like we ran out of time. We can't thank you enough, Jeff, for taking your time and having this conversation with us.
Thank you so much.
It's been a true honor and great pleasure. For anyone who's watching, listening, you can find Staple Pigeon products here at Factory 54, in-store and online, obviously. So thank you very much, Jeff. We want to thank a few people more. So we want to thank Yura and the team at Factory 54 for coming up with this incredible event. Shout out.
I want to give a shout out to everyone who stayed in the store late night and everyone who's sitting there watching. I want to just appreciate your attention and your time doing it through Zoom. I really love you guys just like, you know, listening in. Thank you so much.
Definitely. We want to thank our guy behind the scenes, Nathan. We want to thank the awesome audience which arrived today and the ones back at home that listening and watching us. We are as a podcast Vezen Alaim. Peace.
Peace, everyone. Thanks a lot again.
Thank you, Jeff.
Thank you.